Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham and we're still laughing in association with allfootballshirts.com. Well, in the week of Halloween, it was Nightmare on Village Way for the returning Graham Potter as his Chelsea team were torn apart by a rampant Albion on Saturday. The reception that Graham and his staff received was probably not what he expected, and it's fair to say that his comments after the game were just a touch salty. It was, of course, Robert De Zerbi's first win since taking over from Potter, and he will be hungry for more as we take on Wolves this weekend. In other news, following their 8-0 defeat to Spurs on Sunday, Albion women's boss Hope Powell has stepped down as manager. Raw regular Amy Merricks will take charge of the team at West Ham next weekend.
Nice name dropping, mate. Well done.
And also, both Lewis Dunk and Danny Welbeck have been named in Gareth Southgate's provisional 55-man squad. Yes, 55-man squad for the World Cup. Joining me as we discuss all this and more is, of course, Alan Wares. We're delighted to welcome back journalist, author and musician Nick Trepanic and also Andy Bass. Well, how are we all feeling, chaps? Has the dust settled yet for you all?
No. And it's going to be flying around for a while yet.
I was particularly pleased to notice that Chelsea's website had a complete replay of the whole game on show, whereas, you know, the Albion one just had the two sets of highlights. So if you really want to see Chelsea's humiliation, their own website is the place to see it.
Didn't they have more highlights of their one goal than any of ours, though?
No, it was just straight through, just a straight through feed, but nice watching. So, you know, you could fast forward through to our fourth goal if you wanted to omit most of the second half, which I found quite nervy in the press box the second half, but I just imagine what De Zerbi saying as they went out for the second half, you know, just don't make sure you don't concede an early goal, lads.
Italian. I think we're all saying that, to be honest. Yeah. Listen, we can talk about the game.
Didn't get the memo.
We can talk about the game. We can actually sort of like really talk about it. But I think that the real narrative and the narrative that's from within the Amex, and then you've got the narrative that's within a fair whack of the media, is the notion of booing. Now, booing is, for the most part, a bit childish, for the most part, a bit pantomimey, and sometimes a little bit extreme. But it is an expression of people's feelings on a given matter. Now, why people boo never comes across in the booing itself. So, Nick, bearing in mind that obviously you were in the stadium and reporting on what's happening here, give us a flavour of where within the media, I mean, not necessarily naming names, some got it wrong and some got it right.
Well, the people who get it right are the people who know the club and the history of the club, you know, who actually are regular attenders at games at the Amex. You know, there are, when you play in one of the big clubs, you know, there's that sort of group of reporters, you know, who are basically on the Chelsea beat for their papers and only take any notice of anything Chelsea. Whereas, you know, there are others who are, you know, come down to do Albion matches fairly regularly and know something of the history of the club. And they would have understood it perfectly well. You know, the problem is there's no nuance in a boo, is there? You can't really say the following boo is directed mainly at Todd Boehly, you know, and about 50% of it at Graham Potter and about 20% at Bruno. And, you know, it's just a boo and people hear those things and understand or don't. I mean, the problem was the pundits on the various radio stations in the days that followed, you know, who have, like Jamie O'Hara, who haven't got a clue what's going on and don't do any research. Don't, you know, phone anyone up to find out. I mean, this happens, you know, when there's a story involving the Albion. I'll get calls from some colleagues, you know, at papers in London who'll say, oh, you know, just give us a steer on, you know, would I be right if I say this or is that too strong? And there are others, you know, that who know your number but don't bother and will just, you know, phone one of their mates who doesn't know anything either. You know, if I was asked to do a story about Leeds, I'd phone Dave Anderson of the Mirror, who's up on the Leeds beat and knows everything about Leeds, so that I don't make a fool of myself. But other people, don't seem to be particularly worried about that.
But there were some absolutely glorious sound bites and taglines that were coming out from this. I mean, Jacob Steinberg in The Guardian, who I know he does actually work on the Chelsea beat, I mean, he was saying that Graham Potter's side were completely and utterly outmoved by the side that he no longer manages. And it was... And I can't remember, Sam Wallace at The Telegraph that came up with a brilliant one as well. I can't remember exactly what it was. But
yeah. Oh, it was so, so brilliant, but, you can't remember it.
No, but Sam spent about 20 minutes talking to Andy Naylor and myself in the press room beforehand, you know, and just going over everything that he knew most of it anyway, but just, you know, just getting the background. You know, I mean, that there's a reason why Sam's had a, you know, a pretty impressive career in Fleet Street. It's because he does his research and wants to know stuff. Yeah, Tom Roddy in the Times had you know said something really clever, you know, about the beautiful monster that that Potter had created, ate him up whole. but I mean that point about the you know the how well Potter's team had played, you know, and it, by which he meant Brighton was interesting because I couldn't believe the way Potter set up against the Albion. You'd have thought the one person who knew how to set up at the Amex would be Graham Potter, seeing how many other teams have set up successfully against us there, and then he went and did the exact opposite. Maybe he had a point to prove.
Maybe, I know, but I mean, sorry, Andy, with the getting back to the sort of like the reaction of the Albion fans, you know, and this is because this kind of predates the game. We can talk about it. It was before, during, and after. Is especially the after bit and the reaction of those aspects of the media that Nick was talking about that didn't bother doing their research. I mean, does one, it must stick in your craw, but two, does it stick in your craw further that these same outlets don't offer any Albion fans a right of reply?
I found a lot of the pre-match commentary quite laughable, to be perfectly honest. And yeah, it did annoy me that they didn't really seek out like an Albion perspective on it. I think, to be honest, some of the post-match stuff is actually a lot fairer than the pre-match coverage. I mean, I thought the Observer were really good. Mm. The Guardian Football Weekly was very complimentary towards us and understanding of the fans. And even on the Times Football podcast, Hugh Woosencroft, who had, you know, garnered the ire of some Albion fans on the internet, on Twitter prior to the game, was having to fight his corner against his fellow hosts on that show, and it was a much more nuanced look at why the Albion fans reacted in the way they did. I mean, from my own perspective, I was fully supportive of the booing of Graham Potter. I still feel that, you know, the reason I feel that way is because it was so sharp and it was so quick, the way that everything had been torn down after we were probably still buzzing from the Leicester game, got into fourth, we're looking at the fixture list coming up and thinking, oh, you know what, you know, we get another couple of wins and, you know, we could really sort of establish ourselves up here, and everything was looking great. And then 4 days later, everybody had naffed off. Mm. And we're left wondering what's going to happen. The players are just getting into work and seeing Andrew Crosser saying, what have you done with the rest of them?
I thought Kukurea deserved the booing more, because at least Graham Potter didn't give us some old BS about driving from Heathrow, you know, past Stamford Bridge and thinking that I'd always wanted to manage there.
Yeah, and I was disappointed with Potter. I thought he really believed in the project at Brighton. One of the reasons I'm really upset is because he did do an absolutely fantastic job. And, you know, in time, we will be able to look back favourably on what Graham did, and we'll be able to thank him later. But you know, the water has yet to go under the Stamford Bridge, so to speak, on the hurts that we endured just those few weeks ago. Yeah. You know, it looked like a 3-year project was finally coming to fruition, and then it was like just dropped, you know, just dropped just like that. I think Potter could have chosen his next job from the Albion, but he's just taken he's taken this one. It, you know, to coin a phrase, it is what it is. we got our, you know, we got our revenge on Saturday. I found it very cathartic. I kind of feel less vitriolic about it now.
You see, I mean, there was a thing that I wasn't terribly impressed by Potter's reaction. I think he could have been far more diplomatic. And as for, you know, that's like sour grapes about, well, you know, I never experienced an atmosphere like that when I was here. And you think, well,
yes, he did. That
did make me laugh.
Perhaps that was something to do with the dire home performances. There's such a rewriting of history that, you know, Potter had given us three marvellous years. Well, you know, I'm sorry, the first 2 years promised a lot and delivered not quite so much. I mean, last season was, you know, fantastic, our best season statistically on every level. Although, you know, at half time in the West Ham game, we were sitting in 13th, not 9th. You know, and it wasn't a tremendous transformation from the Chris Hughton time. It took a while, and there were some steps back and some bumps along the road, you know, not least a run of 6 defeats last season. So, you know, all these people who seem to suggest that he'd created some sort of footballing promised land over three seasons were once again, you know, not exactly fully aware of the history.
I think it was all to do with the direction of travel, wasn't it? It was, excuse me, of his last 15 games, I think it was maybe two defeats, and that they'd actually learned how to score. I mean, you know, the narrative over the previous 2-3 years has been that, you know, we're playing well, some attractive football, really nice, easy on the eye, can't score in a month of Sundays. And from that Arsenal game onwards, you could see that finally it was beginning to click into place. And this is, as Andy said, you then see, you think, oh, good, we're going places. And as soon as we've actually found that third gear, he then decides to slam it in reverse. And that's what I think sort of really grates. I mean, if you excuse my sort of clutch-wearing metaphor going to the extreme, it reminds me actually of something that I think it was the Real Madrid fans did when Luis Figo left there. They love their banners abroad, and they said, and I kind of buy into this a little bit, they said, we hate you because we loved you. And I kind of get that. If it had gone, we've discussed this many times. If it had gone in the close season, you'll get it. If it had gone, you know, having finished on a high, absolutely. It's the timing sucked, which to be fair, he has acknowledged. But as you say, now that we've turned them over 4-1, He wasn't particularly diplomatic. He said, I've got nothing to apologise for. Well, fine, no one's asking you to apologise. Right. No one ever called for that. We do acknowledge he did a superb job. Just the way that he left such a bitter taste. And it's not just the way that he left. It's Chelsea's behaviour, their corporate belligerence of attacking a smaller club on account of the fact that they can. And that is what really rankles with, you know, if Aston Villa had done it, we're going, hang on, what's going on?
Well, just a minute, just to play the devil's advocate, what should Chelsea have done if they wanted our manager? People say, you know, if Chelsea wanted that, you know, why didn't they do it themselves? Well, they kind of have done by getting the people who did it for us. And I mean, but what are Chelsea? Are Chelsea the same club that they were under Abramovich or Ken Bates, or by the very fact they've got new ownership, but are they? Are they not a slightly different Chelsea?
Well, wait and see.
Difficult to tell.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll see what happens when results go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, when things are going well and they're building, they're going through a club building exercise the way that Newcastle have been trying to do, then you see them on one aspect of it. But when things start going wrong, it's just indicative of just how poorly run it was that they still managed to win the European Cup whilst being not that brilliantly run. I mean, if you're saying, in answer to your question, Nick, about what would Chelsea have done or what should Chelsea have done, it's just sort of like the impertinence and the rudeness. I mean, they could turn around. The fact they turn around and say, it's just business. These are the same people who then were grizzling when we were holding out for 55 million for Cucurella. Hang on, what do you think you're doing? Well, it's just business. I mean, I'm probably arguing against my own point here, but it's like going up to a to someone and, you know, asking their partner to leave their, the, you know, asking someone to leave their partner just because you're a lot richer. Is that business?
Well, but look, you know, how different is it to what we did to Swansea City when we took Potter and his guys from there? I mean, most of the managers, when you think about a lot of our managers, they've been free agents and we haven't had to take someone from another club.
We took Potter during the close season, though. That for me is what's different.
Andy.
Yeah, I was going to say, some people have been making that comparison and I think it's pretty specious, to be honest. We didn't nick Potter halfway through, right at the beginning of the, right in the middle of the season and then just totally gut them. But it's like, we did it the right way. We approached them in the off season. I mean, you know, we lose players in the transfer windows. We fire managers get, we all understand how that works. Yeah. But the fact is that we were building something, we've gone in momentum, and then it just got taken away during the grant. So it was all right for Chelsea to come in. They were able to come in and just like swoop and get everything, whilst we were in the middle. We were like going forward, and then we had to stop.
Yeah.
I mean, we recovered quickly, but not fully yet, I don't think, from that with De Zerbi. I think De Zerbi's a great appointment and stuff, but is that we've now gone back on our time scale of the improvements we were making.
Yeah.
We've got to get back up to speed again.
Yeah.
But it's all right for Chelsea to do that, but it, you know, just to rip us off. If they'd have done it in the summer, we you know, it would have been less damaging to the momentum of the club.
Yeah, and the other thing, Andy, was, and I know this is a point that you've made already, is the fact that when he left Swansea, he left with what he came with.
Yeah.
When he left us, he left with what he came with, plus Bruno and Ben Roberts, and now maybe Paul Winstanley.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the thing that really rankles with most people. I think I was asked, I think on the Hawksby and Jacobs show while we're name dropping, you know, what sort of reaction he'd get looking ahead to this game. And I said, well, it'll be mixed, and a lot of it will be down to the fact that he took at least one Brighton legend and one former player. And that was, of course, before the Winstanley thing came along. So, you know, that is a factor. But, I mean, you know, the thing is that Chelsea didn't do anything wrong morally, you know, you could say, but nothing actually illegal or against the football rules. And Tony Bloom didn't, you know, attempt to put Graham Potter on gardening leave. And, you know, until there's some sort of football regulator and there's a moratorium on taking managers during the season, then these things will carry on happening.
Okay. And that's where I question the whole policy that the club has over we won't stand in your way.
Mm.
If we have designs on challenging for the top 10, even challenging the top 10, which we are clearly, but, you know, and for a short time had a brief flirtation with challenging the top 4, they're going to seriously look at that concept again. Because, you know, it smacks to me of small club mentality. Yeah, we are a small club, but we're not going to be big if we don't think big.
Okay. Well, let's move it on from that, because, I mean, we know the story. And Andy, I'll stick next to you, so I know just how much you enjoyed the baying pit of animosity on Saturday. So let's talk about the game itself, because it was joyous. And I mean, when we saw the lineup come out at 2 o'clock, I mean, I think we're all a little bit worried when we saw that Danny Welbeck was ill and Joel Veltman was injured. In came Pervis Estupiñán and Karu Mitoma, and the first start for Karu as well. But Pascal Gross at right back, Andy.
Yes, very odd. So, like, the continuously weird placement of players continues apace, whether Graham Potter's here or not. But, you know, it worked. And the atmosphere was incredible. And you can say what you like about the booing and the vitriol and stuff, but it made it. I mean, we need to do that a bit more, in my opinion, get a bit ourselves. Everybody was really heavily invested. I think even though Chelsea were expecting it a bit, they weren't really expecting what they got. And the team responded by flying out the gates. I mean, we could have been three up after 5 minutes. It was just an incredible start. And I just thought, you know what, I thought we got this game. That, you know, Chelsea, on the back foot immediately, and it was just fantastic. The atmosphere was really, really good, and I flipping loved it. I really loved it. I thought it was excellent.
Now, Nick, one person we haven't talked about booing a lot was the crowd zeroing in on Cucurella, and I personally thought it seemed to affect him, notwithstanding the fact that Solly March decided to raise his game and probably played in a way that Cucurella hadn't seen before. So did Potter mention this afterwards?
Well, I mean, Potter admitted he got his tactics wrong, and he needs to look at that. And that was part of it, because, you know, that you can play attacking players as wing-backs. You know, he's played Trossard and Solly March as wing-backs, you know, for us. But I'm sorry, you know, Christian Pulisic and Raheem Sterling as wing-backs was an utter abject failure. And Cucurella was completely left exposed with Solly March running at him. And, of course, Estupiñán was running at Chalabar on the other side, with a 38-year-old centre-back playing his third game in 8 days in between them. I think, you know, Potter basically invited the Albion to attack a weak back three. And Cucurella, you know, it was. I think he looked visibly affected by the crowd. But, you know, he was actually, you know, thrown to the wolves by his manager being asked to, you know, to single handedly defend a flank that had a guy nominally supporting him in Raheem Sterling, who wasn't even interested in coming back into his own half.
Yeah, I mean, it is ironic that one of our last memories of Cucurella playing for us was him crying in front of the North Stand, and he was crying in front of the North Stand again on Saturday. So yeah. Probably the wrong place for him to come off the pitch, I would say. But I mean, he did look visibly upset as he came off the pitch, and I did feel for him a little bit, but not that
really,
much. Not that much. But, well, you know,
the thing is, when we're talking about the morality of those leaving Brighton to go to Chelsea, his was probably in the run up to going. Bearing in mind that obviously Potter's thing was done in about 4.5 seconds flat. The whole Cucurella thing was one of those where you just think you are behaving like an absolute mercenary, even if it's not how you feel. Your own personal PR here sucks.
Well, his agent's version. I think it was his agent, or his people. But he should have had a look at that and said, no, take that rubbish down.
Yes. Yeah, because he's always wanted to. What part of Manchester is Stamford Bridge in?
Yes.
I mean, I mean, that whole driving past Stamford Bridge thing, it's a load of rubbish, really, isn't it? I mean, it's like when Bobby Zamora said he's always supported Spurs. When he went there, it was. It's not
a lifelong West Ham fan to say that. Must have been those words must have been wrenched from his inner being.
But we work into them straight out of the traps. I mean, we were hurrying. We're after every ball, closing them down, and you know, and that first opportunity for Leo, where that lovely lob, which was brilliantly cleared off the line.
It was on target for one.
Well, yeah, I mean, admittedly, it was Thiago Silva's mistake in the first place, but Carew was onto him like a shot and set up Trossard there, and it was just a deft chip, shall we call that?
Yes, it was a deft chip, but actually, fair play to Silva for getting back. And then it's stupid.
Since it was his ball that had been picked off in the first place, he owed them that.
Right, absolutely. And then it's stupid now. Was that his first shot on target, you suppose?
High skill. A half volley from a bouncing ball. That was and on target as well.
Yeah.
I think he's had a shot before, but it was an excellent attempt on goal and required another excellent intervention from the beleaguered Silva. I mean, it just, the momentum was just incredible, and I think Chelsea realised that they were in a game, and then obviously, you know, Matoma gets hold of the ball and does what he does by just running straight at the opposition.
But it was also won back by pressing as well for it to get to Mitoma as well.
Yeah, they all did that. They all had a go at pressing it. And the thing about, I've said before about Mitoma, I think that was his first Premier League start, wasn't
it? Yes, it was, yeah.
And I've said, no, he's not ready to start. And I think it was, again, you saw how bearing in mind how thin we were on the bench, and it's not the rest have gone to Chelsea. That was a bunch of kids on the bench. So Matoma was starting. That's great. I thought, well, no, is he a starter? Is he a, is it, or is he an impact player? No, he's clearly an impact player. We can see that. But I'm kind of glad to say that, you know, he is one of those that can start. But what, and again, they weren't doing it with March and they weren't doing it with Matoma for a long time, is that once you double up on him, he becomes a lot less effective. And I think probably any winger does. But he looked that much better because Chelsea weren't doubling up on him. Eventually, when they did get round to doing it, you know, he looked a little bit sort of weary. He was dead on his feet. Or was it 60, 65 minutes he came off? So where, what he's going to be like for a whole 90, we don't know. But
doubling up, of course, leaves you space somewhere else. And
yes.
Estupiñán, he was still charging down the wing, you know, in the late stages of the second half. He had an absolutely fantastic game.
He was absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's the best crosser of the ball we've got at the club at the moment, I think. I mean, it's like the way he puts the ball right into the danger area, and he actually creates more danger than anybody else, I think.
And I think we can also see him getting, you know, match by match, better and better. Now, he started off pretty reasonably. I think it was up at West Ham was when he started. And he started reasonably, started okay, but you could see that he was not 90 minutes Premier League fit. And there was a couple of times when he was, you know, you could see him sort of out on his feet, gasping, not quite gasping for air. But like, for instance, this game against Chelsea, clearly his best game for us, albeit it's only been about half a dozen, but you can see him getting better game by game. Would you say, Andy?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the West Ham game was brilliant. And then he didn't have the best game against Fulham.
Who did?
I don't think anyone did.
But yes, I mean, he's clearly got a raw talent. I think he's a good crosser of the ball. I think he's actually a pretty good defender as well. He can do both, even though, like, we're primarily going to be looking at his speed in bringing the ball forward and getting into those areas. But yeah, he looks an absolutely excellent player. And we sold Cucurella for 65 million, which is a good price. I've not really got a massive problem with a player going for that amount of money. We got a good reward, and the replacement cost next to nothing compared to that. And he looks like he could go on to be a better player than Cucurella. Yeah. So,
and there was also the handshake, which I did want to talk about. He offered the handshake to Graham Potter late in the game, which some people took as a sign of appreciation, but I took as a bit of prime trolling from Estupiñán. But I'm not really sure about that, so perhaps you shouldn't go down that road. Graham Potter was asked about it for the Monday papers and said it showed that at least somebody inside the ground was appreciative of him, but I'm not so sure.
Oh, dear. Oh, violins.
I mean... It's very hard to be appreciative of a team that came dressed as manila envelopes.
Oh, no, I said their performance was as beige as their kid.
Yeah, that's about right. Okay, well, I mean, we did double our lead.
Sorry, can I just say quickly, AD? I mean, I know the time is moving on. What we really haven't talked about, yes, we talked about the press and we talked about how we came out of the traps. It was, just quickly, Leo's footwork in rounding the keeper and planting it into the bottom corner. Absolutely magic. Yeah. They mentioned it on Match of the Day. Superb. Sorry, goal two.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, let's actually, talking about Leo. I mean, Leo is playing as a central striker or a false nine in Danny's place. So that he was just absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
In ways he wasn't against Fulham, where he played the same role.
Yeah, true. True. I mean, I think
I think it was the Fulham game, they were all a bit lost. They were all a bit at sea. Fulham did a number on us in the way that Chelsea didn't.
Yeah.
And I think that also because there might have even been possibly the change of personnel.
Yeah, man, I guess because our manager in that game was just rubbish. I mean, who was he again? Who was he?
Exactly.
Who was he? Okay. We did double our advantage, and it was the first of two own goals. And it came from a Solly March corner. Now, our corners mostly this season have been, well, it's not really worth us having a corner most of the season, to be fair. But in this game, they're actually a lot better.
Andy, do you ever get excited at a corner?
No. No, I mean, we had a brief period, I can't remember, maybe about 18 months ago when we were doing that traffic light thing, and like Webster seemed to score quite a few headers from corners.
And dunk, yeah.
Effective. But then the sort of, you know, that mojo just sort of wore off very quickly, and then we've been poor. And so it was a welcome change to see us actually benefit from a corner.
I mean, considering that Potter was supposed to be such a great coaching guru, I thought the one area that he didn't seem to take much interest in was set plays. I mean, you'd have expected there'd be something, you know, original and stunning, something different in every game just to keep the opponents guessing. But there really wasn't very much, was there?
No.
Did he eventually employ a set play specialist?
Well, they're paying someone. Well, I don't know whether what they're actually doing for their money.
Well, I mean, what I mean is, and not until a few...
He worked significantly. They didn't take him to Chelsea. Perhaps we should read something into that.
Absolutely.
Now, Nick, one of the hallmarks of Brighton under Graham Potter was that most of the sides we played, their goalkeeper had absolute blinders, and this was still a trait of the Graham Potter side this time. Whereas Rob Sanchez had to be on his game.
Yeah, he's had a few iffy moments, hasn't he, this season? But I think there was one time when he came for a cross and dropped it. But no, he was right back to his form. I mean, his save from Gallagher's header was superb. You know, getting his right hand up into that corner. The save from Gallagher's shot. Some people were saying it was too close to the keeper, but he did what he had to do. And people say that Pulisic should have just buried the rebound in the empty net, but actually, Sanchez was still filling quite a lot of the goal when you saw it from behind the goal, and he was coming for the crosses and claiming things, and I think, you know, giving the back three, the back four, a really, really great sense of well-being there, which of course is what you need.
Can I just say that Pulisic shot was very, very Potter-esque. It was straight out of the Potter playbook, that miss.
Now the third goal, Andy. I mean, it all started with Adam Webster dispossessing Raheem Sterling on the edge of our box, and then it led to a brilliant team move, a fantastic ball from Caicedo to Estupiñán, and I thought Carew had actually scored at first, but it was another own goal, and they all count, don't they?
Well, yeah, to be honest, having watched the goal back again today, I'd forgotten how many passes there were in it. I mean, it must have been bordering on double figures, the amount of passes as we moved the ball up. It was classic De Zerbi ball, very much like that move for Lamptey's rather weak header at Man City. Yeah. But this time we had an end result. And again, it was just a great cross in by Purvis Estupiñán, who basically, Chalobah had no option other than to try and intervene because Matoma was there for the tap-in. He was right behind him. It was going to be a goal either way. And, you know...
What confidence do you have in Brighton strikers?
But, I mean, Nick, do you actually think we are moving the ball quicker under De Zerbi?
Well, it was kind of interesting because Potter more or less admitted, we go back to that Arsenal game as being when everything changed last season, but he admitted that they'd had a look at the team during the international break, which was about that time, and thought that they weren't getting the ball forward quickly enough. So it wasn't just that Caicedo came in. There was also, I think, an attempt to get the ball up the pitch further. And I was thinking of that move when Caicedo played. I think it was Mitoma knocked it back to Caicedo and he sort of zipped it through.
Yeah.
I was thinking under Potter, you know, at the beginning of last season, that ball might have gone back to Dunk and then possibly back to Sanchez. And yet when Caicedo got it, it went straight forward, straight through the defence. Yeah, I think the De Zerbi idea is to zip that ball forward, where, you know, when the chance is there, and I think that was which it also was in, you know, in those nine games at the back end of last season, I think, for Potter. So I was a little bit worried when we heard about, you know, wanting to build up from the 6-yard box, whether we would have sort of regressed to Potter before those last nine games. But I think De Zerbi has looked at it and sort of very quickly decided that we want to get the ball into the final third very quickly. And that was a great example of it.
Can I just say that those 6-yard goal kicks that we take scare the bejesus out of me? I mean, I'm all for risk, high risk and high reward, but they really do sort of take it to the edge, don't they?
Oh, well, if you look at any of the Sassuolo footage, yeah, it's nerve-wracking stuff. But when it works, as it did at Man City in that move that Andy was talking about, then it looks brilliant.
Yeah.
Chelsea did pull one back and it was all a little bit too easy. We don't really want to talk about that. But
I will say this, Andy, it was a really, really good cross. Yeah. If Pascal Gross had put that in, we'd be purring, wouldn't we?
Yeah. But what we were doing, basically Chelsea were beginning to get their upper hand, and what Potter Yee would have done, he would have tried to like shore it up a little bit and bring another defender on. But no, the Zerbi, he's got some sort of like dial on the touchline. He goes, no, we need more pace. So on comes on Ciso. Oh no, we haven't got enough pace. On comes Sarmiento.
On comes Lamptey.
More pace.
Yeah. Not so much more pace, less age.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on Caesar, it was just absolutely delightful to watch, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, his pass selection, his pass ignoring was very refreshing. But, you know, I love the ambition of the guy, you know, just wants to run a play. And that time he took it past the last defender and sort of haired off towards goal. And when you look at it, actually, Silva's positioning was great. I mean, people are saying, oh, he should have set up Trossard, but that would have been very difficult. I think Silva had basically... I mean,
Trossard did his absolute pieces at him.
Just one thing, just go back. Potter's first game away to Watford, he did the same thing, if you remember. He took off two forwards and put two other forwards on, didn't he? I think he put on Mopay and Doney. Yeah. And we went from a 1-0 lead to a 3-0 lead. So Potter used to do that before he became, he got Premier League-itis and thought to play safe. So maybe De Zerbi is still in that sort of first flush of needing to be daring and wanting to, you know, to do something different. But it was a bold move and a great move, and it kept Chelsea at full stretch because obviously they couldn't set into a rhythm and keep building up because they knew that there was this absolute speed merchant waiting to just run at them as soon as he got the chance.
And it was on Ciso's desire to get onto the score sheet that did actually lead to the fourth goal.
Andy, yeah. Could he have played someone else in, or is it just the fact you're appreciative of the fact we've got this kid who's got his head down and just wants to head for goal?
I like the fact that he wants to head for goal. To be honest, I was going to make the same point as Nick. I think the reason we brought on those quick players was to stretch the field and keep Chelsea honest, because I know everyone's been saying how bad Chelsea were in this game, and defensively they were poor because they were set up incorrectly. But they actually had some very good quality attacks that required Sanchez to make good saves. And in the case of Pulisic, you know, the opportunity which he would probably want to take back and shoot better. So they could have scored more goals. They had opportunities. And I think, you know, Chelsea were in that second half, were threatening to get back into the game. But when you bring on Enciso, Lamptey and Sarmiento, Chelsea couldn't bung everybody forward because, as Nick was saying, everybody we put on our speed merchants. Yeah. I think with the Trossard thing, again, Nick actually said it quite right. If there was a small window there for him to pass to Trossard. Once that had closed, I thought he was right to carry on and just try for the shot himself. Yeah. And as for the assist for Gross's goal, absolutely fantastic. Thumping shot. Then just go back again, hit it again, and then good things happen when you have shots on target. Yeah. And Gross was there to finish it off.
Gross, who started the game at right back and ended up, you know, the furthest man forward to score. Yeah. That's
fantastic.
Love that.
And just a quick word for the referee, who was fine for the first 55 minutes, and then just remembered that he was playing, you know, he was reffing a top six versus other 14 side. And every time they just dropped to the floor, they were getting their free kick. I mean, the one that near the end where Lamptey was going down the wing and he got absolutely clattered and the ref said, no, get up. Whoever the defender was missed the ball completely and took Lamptey out on what should have been actually a yellow card, let alone a free kick. So
there was a couple of those. I mean, there was one, there should have been a second yellow. I can't remember who it was for, Andy. You remember that?
Kovacic.
Kovacic, yeah, that's it. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's fair to say that we all had an absolutely wonderful Saturday afternoon. And let's hope for another one this weekend. But you are listening to The Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And as ever, in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has provided us with another lovely shirt for us to all enjoy. So who'd like to have a go at describing this one, Nick?
It's a white Adidas shirt with that design goes back, I think I'm thinking sort of 1990 World Cup design, you know. I have a sort of sneaking feeling that I know roughly where it comes from, and I'm thinking Turkey.
You're good.
I was thinking the same, actually, yeah.
But I think that's because I think I know that the sponsor I've seen it somewhere on a Turkish shirt. I can't remember which club.
You're allowed to say the sponsor's name.
Is it IGAS or something, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also looking at the badge where it's been partially photoshopped, but you can still see the numbers 1903. So can I plump for a guess here?
You can.
Is it Beşiktaş?
Yes, it is.
Oh, two in a row.
Black and white.
There you go. Works. Well, you know, speaking of black and white, I think IGAS is a gas company from Newcastle, isn't it? This is what...
That's why I guess.
This is what Phil has to say about this particular shirt. He says, here is your shirt of the week, chosen because I quite like it, and it's a local local team of my good friend, Cihan Baz. This is a Beşiktaş shirt, and it was used in home cup games in the 1989 to 1990 season. There you go, Nick. Beşiktaş Gymnastik Kubilu were formed in 1903, and they play in the Turkish Super League, where they are currently fourth. Nicknamed the Karakatala, which translates to be the Black Eagles, they play at the 42,590 capacity Iunu Stadium, which for sponsorship reasons goes under the name of Vodafone Park. They were the first ever registered sports club in Turkey and one of the few ever allowed to use the Turkish flag on its crest. They've been relegated from the top flight, but they've won it. They've never been relegated from the top flight, and they've won the league 21 times and have won 25 domestic cups. There are many decorated former players. Riza Kumbay played over 500 times for the Black Eagles in the 80s and 90s, also playing 40 times for the national team. Mehmet Sifor Odizek is another prolific player, playing 386 games, scoring 130 goals in the 90s. Links to the UK? Well, there are a few. Here's an odd one for you. Daniel Amakachi spent 2 years at Everton before his move to Beşiktaş in 1996, and he is now a member of the dubious goals panel for the Premier League. Dubious. Dele Alli is currently on loan from Everton. John Carew made his name around Europe, including a spell at Beşiktaş before playing for Villa, Stoke and West Ham, where he hung up his boots in 2012. Ryan Babel, Demba Ja, Michy Batshuayi, Kevin Prince-Boateng and Les Ferdinand have all plied their trade in both Istanbul and the UK. No link to the Seagulls for you this week, but I will leave you with the fact that Beşiktaş are the only club in the world that has both a championship-winning football team and a championship-winning fencing team. And Bruce Dickinson would no doubt approve. Thank you very much for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. And some of them are absolute beauties and some of them most definitely are not. Let's move on to the other big news at the club this week, which was Hope Powell. Andy, she's stepped down after the 8-0 home defeat to Spurs at the weekend. And I don't think many people thought it was that much of a surprise.
No, not really. I think with the growing interest in the women's game, I think the Albion are keen for us to kick on. And whilst over the last few years we have made great strides, we seem to be plateauing now with the women's team, and you know, as interest grows, you don't want to take that step back. And yeah, I just, from what Hope was saying, I think she felt that she didn't really have too much more to offer. The team at the moment, given that, you know, we, especially as we lost so heavily at the weekend, and so it's a bit a new chapter awaits for the women's team, and I hope it's going to be a good one. You know, you got to, I think it reminds me almost a little bit of when Chris Hughton went. I think you have to acknowledge great work that they do in building up the foundations for the club, but then you have to you reach a point where you think, well, you've kind of done as much as you can. And we need somebody else to progress.
Well, the best suggestion came from Vicky of this parish, saying we should go to Chelsea and get Emma Hayes and her entire backroom staff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go and nick them now. Because unfortunately, like now in the women's game, you always had Chelsea and Arsenal and Man City who were quite strong in the game, but now you've got Liverpool, Manchester United in particular have come to the game late, but they're now taking it seriously
and starting to invest. Yeah,
yeah, and now you've got, and then obviously in Europe you've got Barca, is it Lyon, and just like already you're getting that same old stuff in the women's game that you're getting in the men's game, and we could fall behind.
Yeah, and obviously we've got a following on from the success of the Lionesses in the summer. I mean, you know, the Albion would have been hoping to kick on. Obviously, they wanted to have the first two home games at the Amex. Obviously, one of them got called off.
I think it's important. I mean, following up from what Andy's saying there, I think it's important to put some historical context onto this. In as much as hope was brought in just when the Women's Super League was starting, so I think it was important to bring in someone with some nous, some experience, some knowledge of what it was required, because at the time, you know, it wasn't 100% certain as to how the whole Women's Super League thing was going to go. I mean, there's a lot of media that are trying to promote it, the BBC especially, but it still could have died on its backside, and the likes of what happened in the summer this year have really helped. But you can't help feeling that what we actually brought in was someone with experience, but not with any sort of too many progressive ideas. And so the time had come. I mean, there was a certain amount of flux in the women's team. It was something like 18 months between the Albion getting promoted at that playoff that was at Wigan Wanderers against West Brom. Excuse me. And the Super League starting, there was a long time to waiting. Everyone was twiddling their thumbs a bit. It wasn't great for the national game as a whole, that there wasn't really a sort of proper admin in place. So having someone like Hope Powell there was probably a good way to start. But I think after this time now, and the 8-0, it wasn't down to the 8-0. The 8-0 was the camel that broke the straw's back, I think is the phrase. Or straw that broke the camel's back.
One of the two.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know. It was the camel cigarettes that broke the straw's back. That's it. And yeah. You can't help feeling that, yes, it's time we should progress. And as Andy said, we are in serious danger of being left behind in the rush. And now is the perverse irony is, as much as we're moaning about, oh, you know, our season's got to, you know, it's got to sort of take hold again after, you know, just two or three games or four or five games like they did with the men. But in this instance, I think it's for the better that someone else comes in. Yeah. Who it will be is not going to be obvious. You'd like to think that the club's little black book on that they have on men coaches around the world is going to be just that the women's one is just as thick and salacious and pertinent. But yeah, exciting times for the women's team. But you know, let's just remember that we did have a giant of the women's game, you know, for our club, and I think that I kind of find that satisfying that she was here.
Well, yeah. well, one good news that did come out of the women's side today was that Katie Robinson's been called up for the four Lionesses squad for the November international. So good luck to her, and good luck to Lewis Dunk and to Danny Welbeck, who they've been called up for the 55 man. Provisional World Cup squad, which basically means they probably will be going on the warm weather training with the rest of the Brighton team come the 13th of November.
Nick, aren't you number 56?
Yeah, and Solly March is 58, and Adam Webster is 60, yeah, something like that. Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we knew this 55-man thing was coming on various, as soon as it was even mentioned on various sort of football phone-ins, people were speculating on who might be, you know, the extra 20 or 30 players called up, and I remember Lewis was mentioned in an early one of those. I think it's probably everyone that's ever been in a Southgate squad, you know, and a few others who might be making a late run. But
Southgate's
under 21, so perhaps he should call up and say, hey, what about me?
I don't think Danny Welbeck's been in the Southgate squad, though. Has he?
Southgate squad, but you know, he's a former England regular and feasted on Andorra and San Marino and teams like that.
It's only 4 years ago since he played for England. But Andy, I mean, in reading all this on social media, I also sort of read some Albion fans saying, well, hang on, why is Danny Welbeck there? He hasn't scored for us this season. Isn't that good? Discuss.
Well, it's true. Danny Welbeck hasn't scored. I think, and to be honest, I think he should have scored. Should have got a couple of goals this season. I think he's missed a couple of chances, which I think he'd be disappointed with. But he does. He does have a role in that side. I mean, he's perfect for stretching the field. That's just why he was so useful in that 15-game run under Graham Potter, because he was crucial to relieving pressure and strengthening potent attacks. So there's a lot more. It's like, you know, so we're looking for a striker. Well, you know, Trossard scored more goals at this stage than any striker scored for us. So is he not a striker now? It's just a footballer that contributes to the team on the pitch, and if it makes the team better, it makes the team better, and you should be there.
And actually, his goal scoring record for England's always been better than it has been at club level.
Yeah, but I think that goes back to who he scored against. I mean, England didn't play teams as good as the Albion are playing week in and week out.
I would be surprised if Welbeck makes the final, whatever.
Really? Would be.
Not surprised as Welbeck will be.
It'll be interesting to see if Lewis can make an impression, you know, in the squad. I mean, you know, the World Cup, I don't really care about it. But, you know, I think Lewis deserves a recognition.
Yeah, in your opinion, Andy, is there anyone else, you know, I mean, not that we've got that many England players, but do you feel that if Welbeck and Dunk made it to the 55-man squad, that maybe Webster and March could have done as well?
I don't see why they shouldn't at least be being discussed by the powers that be in the England setup. I think they should definitely be in the conversation, and they should be watched. Am I personally clamouring for them to get into the team? Not really, no. But
there you go. Okay, well, we are running out of time, Andy. So we'll just move on quickly to Paul Barber announced that during the World Cup, there's going to be some ground improvements. They're bringing in a tunnel club, Nick. That'll be popular.
Manchester City have got something like that, haven't they? It involves sort of glass walls to the tunnel so that people can sit next to them, next to the tunnel, and see what's going on down there. And my experience, you know, sitting quite close to the tunnel in the press box is not an awful lot of that's that interesting. But
do you know what this I'm sure
Paul Barber has researched this and feels that the Albion can get some financial benefit out of it. I'd quite like him to move the press box back a bit so that you can get a better view of the pitch, but I don't really see how he's going to do that.
Well, that's where the tunnel club's going to be, I think. So maybe that is going to happen. So,
Andy, quick. This, for anyone that ever knows about it, this reminds me of a Far Side cartoon where you've got some scientists looking through this glass panel at these sort of odd people, and the caption just reads, "Yes, gentlemen, they're fools. But what kind of fools are they?" That's what I've got in mind as to what this tunnel club's going to be like. Sorry, carry on, Aid.
But yeah, I mean, probably the most important improvements are going to be externally. They're going to put more concessions around the outside of the stadium. And maybe I think there has been talk of them putting toilets in there for a while. So I don't know. I think that's going to be, they're not going to have enough time probably to do that this time around. It's probably one for post-season. But I mean, what they really need to do is put more concessions inside the grounds. I mean, Nick,
give us a for instance, mate. Give us a for instance as to what you have in mind.
Well, I mean, the problem. I know that there's spacing issues and things like that. But I mean, you know, but if you take the West End upper, for instance, we've got a couple of the concessions there that haven't been open this season, and you know, it's impossible. The queues are just ridiculous. And I mean, when we come out, I mean, we're fortunate enough to be in press boxes up and down the country, and therefore we get to see what other home concourses are like, and it seems to be that there's just a lot less queuing and a lot easier to get.
Do you know why that is, though? Because I think fewer people, pro rata, go into their home ground for a beer. One, a lot more places have pubs nearby. And two, you have to remember the Albion actively encourage people to come in. And especially, no, admittedly, I know you're not thinking of it in those terms, especially encourage people to stay behind as well. I mean, Andy, we all like a pie and a pint. I mean, the fare at the Albion is not too shabby, is it?
No, there's nothing wrong with the offer, but I would say that the service has gone backwards. To be honest, I mean, I think AD's right. I mean, we were discussing it. It's probably why we're talking about it now. Because I was actually, I mean, I'm glad that that Paul has been looking at extending the facilities outdoors. We've got a great space, and it was good when we began doing things outside. But again, like other clubs now, with other clubs have got fan zones and things like that, I think are much better than ours and give fans a lot more to do outside than we do at the moment. And I do think that the service in that they need to take a look at like the queues in the ground. I mean, to be honest, I'm not that fussed about getting a pint at half time anymore. But it's a good job, but I'm not that fussed about it because
we haven't been able to get one this season, I think.
It's just
absolutely crazy.
But it does all seem to be a bit slow. I don't know why that is, and you know, but I think it's something they should be looking into, because I think there will be some lost revenue. Obviously, I know that the Albion don't get all the money for that because Sodexo pay for the privilege. But
they just need to open more. Open more
concessions. But there are outlets that were open.
That's the key to it. Yeah. But I mean, where you put them, I don't know.
I think that is key, though, isn't it? I mean, that little kiosk that was going to be a betting booth, that's never open. I know they also talked about the little sort of mobile Harvey's bar. If you're going to have more concessions outside, it's absolutely imperative they put potties out there. Because anyway, like I say, it's a football stadium, not a cafe.
Of course, that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you, of course, to Alan Wares. Thank you to Andy Bass. Thank you to Nick Trepanic. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. And of course, in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you again next week. Cheers. Two pots of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Two pots of lager and a packet of crisps, please. I'll have two pots of lager and a packet of crisps, please. I'll have some pickled onions and a little bit of cheese, please. Thank you. Two pots of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Two pots of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Two pots of lager and a packet of crisps, please. And I've got all the right money and all that, please. Thank you. Wait, two parts of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Hey, two parts of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Two parts of lager and a packet of crisps, please. I've been here half hour and I'm getting very thirsty. Two parts of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Over here. Wait, two parts of lager and a packet of crisps, please. Two parts of lager and a packet of crisps, please. What won't you serve me?
No!